Hi there, and good evening, and welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, and on the web at jimbotalk.net. Well, oil prices, boy, they're getting to be a problem. Gasoline, of course, most of us don't go around buying a whole lot of barrels of crude, but we do buy the stuff that comes from it in a lot of different ways. Of course, gasoline, we know, but a lot of stuff, plastics, pharmaceuticals, bunches of stuff comes from oil, and oil hit a new record today of $104.52 a barrel. Just to look at the different ways that oil prices can affect us, well, for example, we love pizza a lot, and in fact, we love it so much that buying pizza is considered fairly recession-proof. But as Anthony Mason reports, the skyrocketing price of fuel and food is sharply cutting into the profits of America's pizza purveyors.
The Connie's Pizza chain moves millions of pies a year across Chicago, and pizza usually moves faster in a slowing economy.
Next year it's going to be $60.
But co-owner Mark Stolfi says his profits are being eaten up by the cost of food and gas.
Cheese is up, flour is up, gas is up, and those are the three biggest components of the cost of a pizza delivered to your door.
With crude hitting another all-time high, gas is now averaging $3.17 a gallon. That's 69 cents higher than a year ago.
Demand is outstripping supply.
President Bush has urged OPEC to up production, but OPEC won't pump more oil. If prices are high, OPEC's president said they're not due to a lack of crude. They're due to what's happening in the U.S. In the U.S., the dollar is taking a nosedive. It hit an all-time low against the euro. And because oil is traded in dollars, it's getting cheaper for overseas buyers to fill up.
The dollar keeps falling. I think oil becomes much more attractive to certain kinds of investors, and I think it will keep upward pressure on oil.
Not good news for you or Mark Stolfi, who's watched the monthly gas bill for 25 pizza delivery trucks jump from $9,000 to $12,000.
So my biggest fear is, what am I going to do next year?
This pizza man worries whether his business can keep delivering profits with an economy running out of gas. Anthony Mason, New York.
So that's just one example of how we are all impacted. We're talking tonight with a man who knows something about this. He is John Hoffmeister, the president of Shell Oil USA. He's had a distinguished career in American business, spending 15 years with General Electric and 5 years each with the companies now known as Nortel and Honeywell International. Mr. Hoffmeister, good evening. Good to have you with us tonight.
Thank you, Jim. It's a delight to be here.
So why is oil so expensive now?
Well, as the president said, demand is outstripping supply, and that does drive the price higher. But here's where I would differ with the president. We should not be asking OPEC to increase production if, in the United States of America, we're not able to increase our own production. We have a perverse public policy in this country that prevents the oil companies from exploring and producing oil in our own country. We're limited to 15% of the outer continental shelf. We're not allowed to search or drill for oil on federal lands, hundreds of thousands of square miles in this country. We cannot ask other countries to support our needs if we are not developing our own resources. People talk about the falling dollar. One of the reasons the dollar is falling is we're shipping boatloads of dollars to oil exporting countries while we won't develop our own natural resources.
I believe that the cost of oil is up about 37% from last summer, something like that.
That's about right.
Yeah. I've heard it said that some economists believe that it actually should be around $80 a barrel. Is that a function just of the devalued dollar, or is it a function of our lack of obtaining oil in this country? I mean, are there other factors at work here besides just supply and demand?
Yeah, supply and demand is, of course, the biggest driver overall, and demand has barely nudged down even with the soft economy. In fact, our own refineries are running flat out at Shell just to keep up with our own demand to supply our Shell stations. But here's a couple factors that enter in. One is the geopolitics of oil. The geopolitics of oil drive traders crazy or make them happy, depending upon the volatility of the day, because there's always a threat that oil may be cut off somehow, mm-hmm. somewhere. Secondly, there's a bit of speculation. Any commodity price, any commodity product, is going to have a certain amount of speculation. I frankly think that's fairly low, but speculators will always try to take advantage of a situation. And I think the third issue is the falling price of the dollar, the falling value of the dollar, does inflate the current price of crude.
Of course, in terms of the world political stability and the impact that that has, we have the usual problems in the Middle East, exacerbated by some of the recent violence in Gaza, the continued questions of just where Iran is going with its foreign policy, the continuing war in Iraq. Now we have tensions between Colombia and major oil producer Venezuela in our own neighborhood. So that's, I suppose, contributing to it, right?
And the irony of all of this is there's 100 billion barrels of known oil in the continental and outer continental shelf of the United States of America. Why aren't we allowed to go produce it?
Albeit, why aren't we?
It's a public policy where the Congress has declared a moratorium on any oil exploration or production off the East Coast or the West Coast. We're not allowed to go into the eastern Gulf of Mexico except for a small slice that Congress agreed in 2006 that we could explore, about 1 million acres, which is helpful, but it's a very small amount of the Gulf of Mexico. And all we can do is pursue the Arctic region of Alaska, which the MMS has in their five-year plan, which is great, except how do you get
the MMS, I'm sorry.
The Minerals Management Service, sorry, of the Department of the Interior. But here's the problem with offshore Alaska. How do you get it to the United States, the lower 48? The pipeline, the Prudhoe Bay pipeline, is way over on the east side of Alaska. The Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea are to the north and to the west of Alaska, and you're talking huge distances up there, so we need a new pipeline if we're going to be able to ship new crude from Alaska offshore to the lower 48.
Why is this other drilling not allowed off our east and west and southern coasts? I mean, the opponents of that, I'm sure, did not get up in the morning and say, yeah, how can I screw my country today? There must be some rationale. What is that rationale?
Let me not blame elected officials, because that's a trip down a slippery slope. Let me blame my own industry. The oil industry has not done the world's best job of expressing itself. The hostility that exists between customers who buy our product and our industry is at an all-time record low, high. I mean, hostility is high. The oil industry has got to do a much better job of communicating its message to the American people and to the American policymakers. So I don't actually blame Congress. I think we've done a poor job of explaining. But when you come, yes, environmental concerns led to the moratorium on the East and West Coast. But what we failed to do is to explain fully what a great environmental job track record we have now. If you look at the hurricane-rich Gulf of Mexico, and for example, in the summer of 2005 with Katrina Rita, we had five other named hurricanes. We had to shut down our platforms. Nobody read about oil spills on the beaches of the Gulf of Mexico. We know how to manage this now.
It's the same old story. A cat stuck in a tree is news. 10,000 cats that didn't get stuck in a tree aren't news. And yet, of course, obviously it ought to be if you're concerned about cat safety. And if you're concerned about oil exploration safety, then you ought to be concerned about also all the times that things didn't happen that theoretically could have. I think I speak for a good many Americans in saying that I am not interested in seeing the Exxon Valdez replicated every other weekend. But on the other hand, it hasn't been. And furthermore, you have to weigh things. You have to weigh the relative dangers of, on the one hand, a spill that can happen. Caca happens, okay? You go out and you drill and you pump, and there will be occasional problems. You weigh that against the very real, very concrete problems of $3, $3.50 a gallon, the impact on the economy, leaving us open to blackmail from rather unsavory regimes. In that world of weighing real-world options, the risk of an occasional spill is frankly by far the lesser of two evils.
Well, that's one reason I went on the road and took 250 Shell executives with me. Between June of 06 and the end of last year,
50 cities over 18 months.
We visited 50 cities. We talked to 15,000 Americans face-to-face, shoulder-to-shoulder. In fact, when we had a town hall, we didn't have but one chair for every 10 persons, which made sure that we would stand shoulder-to-shoulder, eyeball-to-eyeball with the people who visited with us during their town halls. And we had a wonderful, humbling experience where we learned how little Americans really know, because we haven't told them, shame on us, we haven't told them what they need to know about the energy business.
We're going to talk some more about that particular dialogue in a minute. Right now, let's take a call at 1-866-50-JIMBO with Jim, who is in Endicott, New York. And, Jim, good evening.
Hi. I just want to say that don't you think it's a brilliant strategic move, really, to use our oil here in the U.S. last when the prices are higher? And don't we really need that for synthetic products, plastics, the manufacturing?
Well, we use oil for a lot of things, but I think how we use it doesn't alter the fact that demand is up, whether we burn it or synthesize it in a laboratory or a factory someplace, Mr. Hoffmeister.
Yeah, there were quite a few suggestions as we did our town halls around the country. Why don't we do exactly what you said, save our oil for last? But here's the rub. The oil age will not end for the lack of oil any more than the Stone Age did not end for the lack of rocks. In other words, it's my view, and I think shared by many people, that the oil age will in fact come to an end because technology will replace oil. There are many, many options and alternatives. So what I think we have is a next 10 to 20 year opportunity to really drill that oil and use it, because 20, 25 years from now, I believe we'll reach a tipping point, for example, for mobility, transport, and we will be choosing other kinds of technology in our automobiles that don't use gasoline.
Okay. Anything else, Jim?
Hello?
Yes, I said anything else?
I just want to say I would like to see a solar collector in every car and every house in the United States, and the only tipping point I'm really worried about is global warming. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, very good. I'm not sure about solar collectors on cars, unless he means the silicon collectors that turn sunlight directly into electricity. But we'll talk about some of those energy options when we come back here on the Jim Bohannon Show. John Hoffmeister of Shell USA on the Bohannon Show. Get a fixed-rate loan that you can live with. Go to LendingTree.com today or call 1-800-555-TREE. LendingTree. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show as we talk with John Hoffmeister, the president of Shell Oil USA, about the situation with gasoline prices soaring way past $3 a gallon. Oil this past day reaching a new record high of $104.52 a barrel. In this national dialogue on energy security that you delivered around the country, you addressed what you call seven myths about oil. Let's go through them. What are they? Let's start with number one.
It's actually myths that we learned from the people we talked to. And one of the myths that is, we just talked about it with the last caller, and that is that we're running out of oil. Actually, we're not running out of oil. There's far more oil yet to be discovered than we've ever used. The peak oil theory has really infected a lot of people's thinking to believe that we're really running out of it. We're just not allowed to produce it. But there's so much conventional oil. I mentioned 100 billion barrels that we could produce in this country. And around the world, there's much, much more than that. And then there's unconventional oil.
Shale oil, for example.
Shale oil in Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, over a trillion barrels.
For those who don't know, that is oil that is essentially locked in rocks, but it can be extracted.
And we've been doing research on how to extract it as a liquid by heating the rocks, and the molecules will eventually move their way out of the rocks. There's oil sands in Canada, another trillion barrels. There's heavy oil in Venezuela, where there's probably another trillion barrels. So just in our hemisphere, we're looking at 3 trillion barrels. We've never used even a trillion barrels in this world. There's 3 more to go. And so there's much more oil in this hemisphere than there is anywhere in the other hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, do we have the technology, the will, the wherewithal to produce that oil? And that's a very serious question for the country.
Before we get to the next one here, let's take a call from Phil in Traverse City, Michigan. Good evening.
Good evening. Great program. I just want to mention that oil is still cheap and plentiful. It costs us less to buy a gallon of gas than it does a gallon of milk. At $1.2 trillion barrels of proven oil reserves, using about 90 million barrels a day, that would last us 40 years without finding any additional proven reserves. But my real question is, why in this country don't we go towards more nuclear power? It is clean, it's safe, we can reuse the used fuel rods, we can store them safely. Other countries like France have gone almost exclusively nuclear for their electric generation. And is it just the propaganda from the Three Mile Island crowd, or why haven't we gone nuclear?
Well, I can give you a couple of answers. I'm sure Mr. Hoffmeister has more. One is, of course, the potential for sabotage by terrorists. Another is that I believe that nuclear power without subsidies has not proven to be, frankly, economical, competitive. And also there's the issue of where you store the waste, but I'll defer to Mr. Hoffmeister.
Well, let me just pick up with the last item that you mentioned, the issue of storing waste. There is really, in the nuclear industry, which is about 20% of American power today, there is a huge concern that we were made aware of, given that we're part of an energy industry overall, huge concern about how the nation has not come to grips with this, with the waste issue. The Yucca Mountain is a proposal to store nuclear waste from across the country under the earth in Yucca Mountain. That's in Nevada, but that's never been approved as a public policy after 30-some years of debating it.
The nation's biggest NIMBY, not in my backyard, huge issue out of Nevada. My personal answer would be it's got to be in somebody's backyard, and if you've got a better backyard you can point to, fine. Otherwise, shut up. Of course, that's merely me speaking.
But there is talk now of potential nuclear renaissance. But there are three things that we have to figure out how to manage if we're going to have a nuclear renaissance, which I believe is possible. One is the human capability to grant permits is all retired because we haven't granted new permits in 20, 30 years. So the people that know about permitting have to be hired, retrained to understand what's involved in permitting nuclear facilities. Secondly, the nuclear plant construction industry has essentially, in this country, disappeared because we haven't built a nuclear plant. So we have to teach skilled tradesmen how to build the kind of things they need to build that are fit for purpose for a nuclear industry. And thirdly, we have the issue of the permitting, the construction, and the uranium mining industry.
Mm-hmm.
The uranium mining industry has really gone backwards because there hasn't been a demand for new uranium, so we have to restart a uranium mining industry.
And another thing that should be considered, too, quite frankly, Phil, and that is the boogeyman issue, which is that people say nuclear, radiation, ooh, it's the boogeyman. Yes, radiation can be bad. There's also radiation that does a lot of good things, too, in the hospital applications. There's radiation on radium dials on wristwatches. Radiation is just a scare word that a lot of people get upset about. I mean, let's face it, there are also problems that exist from the emissions of fossil fuels, too. So the idea that radiation is often this netherworld of evil and mysterious is just, frankly, so much Luddite hokum. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, 1-866-505-4626. And we'll continue our discussion here and do more calls as well and take a look at some more of these myths regarding the production of energy around the world from the National Dialogue on Energy Security that was put forth all across the country in some 50 cities over 18 months by our guest in this portion of the Jim Bohannon Show. John Hoffmeister is the president of Shell Oil USA. We are at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. We'd love to hear your thoughts as well about something that is certainly coming to affect us all. We'll be back here at Westwood One. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. We're talking with John Hoffmeister, the president of Shell Oil USA, about some of these myths of oil exploration and production, and, of course, more calls as well. Let's hit a couple more of these here. Number two, I think we're up
well,
to.
Well, I think the second myth is that oil prices are artificial. Now, some people think that a company like Shell actually sets the price of oil. The reality is, with Shell's 3-plus million barrels a day of production on a total basis of 85 million barrels a day, we don't produce enough oil to impact the price of oil. And in addition, when we get to the price of oil at the pump, the price of gasoline at the pump, that's more set by a combination of factors such as the cost of replacing the wholesale oil that or gasoline that the dealers buy and what's happening on the local street. And what kind of state taxes are being paid, and what kind of demand or supply relationship is there in what part of the country. So I was on the North Slope of Alaska 2 weeks ago, and they're paying about $6 a gallon on the North Slope of Alaska for gasoline that was barged up there last summer, because you can't resupply the North Slope of Alaska during the winter because it's all iced over in the Arctic Circle.
So they're paying, in the United States, albeit a corner of the United States, they're paying $6 a gallon for gas.
That's right. At $5.80, $5.85, nearly $6, depending on which village you visit. Mm-hmm. And so in other parts, if you go down, you know, around the Gulf Coast where the refineries, a lot of refineries are located, and the state tax is low, you'll find something might be under $3 in today's market. In the Washington area where we're broadcasting from, I think it's around $3.15, something like that. There aren't a whole lot of refineries on the East Coast anymore. Mm-hmm. So you get most of your gasoline here from a pipeline that comes up from the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the supply demand in this region is very high. I mean, the demand is very high. The supply is coming up through a pipeline.
How much of that $3.15 or whatever it is taxes?
Probably between 15 and 20%, depending on the state. Mm-hmm. The big cost is the crude oil. That's about 55 to 58% of the cost of a gallon of gasoline.
I understand that at Shell you believe that there should be a cap on emissions.
Yes.
Really? That seems like an energy producing company viewpoint somehow.
Well, here's the reality in the United States today. We use 21 million barrels a day. Now, it's hard for anybody to imagine what does 21 million barrels look like. So let's translate it. It's 10,000 gallons a second. That's a backyard swimming pool of oil being consumed by Americans every second of every minute of every hour of every day, today, tomorrow, the day after tomorrow, and it's relentless, 10,000 gallons a second. Coal, we use 20 train car loads of coal in this country every minute. That's every 3 seconds we burn 120 tons of coal. Natural gas, if we use 60 billion cubic feet a day of natural gas. If we built a tower of those cubic feet, it would go from here to the moon and back 25 times. So these are all man-made emissions. Shell's reached a point, actually 10 years ago, we decided as a company that man-made emissions are something that should be managed, that we have the technology, we have the knowledge, the know-how, that if we could manage these emissions down, the world is a better place. And so we've been calling for a cap on emissions set by government, whether that's the U.S. government, global governments of nations around the world. We think it's time to cap emissions and create a market-based mechanism to incentivize companies to manage emissions down.
My guess is that doesn't make you popular with some of your competitors.
Not with some of our competitors, but we're entitled to our view.
Fair enough. Let's take some more calls here. This is Laura in Reading, Pennsylvania, for John Hoffmeister of Shell Oil USA. Hello, Laura.
Oh, you sound like a great person for an oil person. Hey, that you really care about the environment and stuff.
For a horrible person, you seem okay. Okay, go ahead.
Well, you know, the public opinion.
Okay.
I wanted to ask what's up with this. I keep hearing people talk about abiotic oil, that oil is something produced by the earth, and it has nothing to do with fossils or dinosaurs or whatever.
That's a good question, and this is where the oil companies can do a really good job of communicating. Where does oil come from? Oil basically comes from carbon deposits. Carbon deposits is old plant life. People talk about dinosaurs. They're just talking about the age of the dinosaurs. Mm. The dinosaurs themselves are carbon-based, just like we human beings are carbon-based. And what happens is, and why the Outer Continental Shelf is so popular these days in terms of exploration and production, is rivers have been carrying masses of carbon deposit, vegetation, floating down the Mississippi River into the Gulf of Mexico for hundreds of millions of years. These have accumulated at the bottom of the sea, and with the heat and the pressure of the weight on top of them, it's turned these carbon molecules into what today we call hydrocarbons, which is oil or gas. Mm-hmm. And so the Earth is continuously producing from carbon deposited under the Earth with the heat and the pressure of that weight,
exactly.
Always producing more oil. Now, we can't really sit around and wait for another 100 million years. to refill the Gulf of Mexico, most of us won't be here. But we can go find other sources of oil, and like we are in the Arctic Circle off the coast of Alaska.
Yeah. I think it gets basically what Laura was talking about, and I've heard this brought up on the program before. As you've explained, oil principally comes from the byproduct of vegetation, which has decayed and been put under tremendous pressure over millions of years. But apparently there is the view out there, and I'm not sure if it's one of these internet myths or what have you, that oil is also produced in other ways, non-biological bases, that things other than vegetation produce oil. And I have always approached that rather skeptically. I've never heard anybody actually offer proof to that.
It has to have carbon molecules in it.
Exactly, and carbon ultimately tends to come from organic things. So the short answer is, Laura, no. Chris in Alta Vista, Virginia, good evening.
Good evening, Jim. I have a question about a couple of Shell motor oil products for Mr. Hoffmeister.
Mm-hmm.
For years, I was a loyal Quaker State user. Always have been, always will be. And they were acquired by Pennzoil, and then Sopus Products acquired the Pennzoil Quaker State Company. My question is, are Pennzoil and Quaker State the exact same thing, except one comes in a green bottle and one comes in a yellow bottle, or is there a different formulation and each one has its own benefits?
It's a good question. And what we do is we have different brands, so you could buy, and Shell does own the Pennzoil brand, Shell does own the Quaker State brand these days, and what we try to do is target a product to a market that likes that particular product. And so there is a chemical difference in these products that meet the specifications that we declare under the brand. So you're actually buying something that's a little bit different. I mean, all oil is oil. And when it comes out of the refinery, based on federal requirements, all oil is basically the same. But it depends then what do you add to that oil to make it unique. And so if you're buying Pennzoil or you're buying Quaker State, you're buying slightly different oils, not by very much, but it is slightly different. But there are differences that you can, you know, your car may like one versus the other.
All right, thank you. And to Alan in Escanaba, Michigan, hello.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. I have several questions. I'll try to be brief. But the first one is Shell Oil still a American-held company?
Shell Oil is an American company. It's a Delaware company, but we are 100% owned by Royal Dutch Shell. And we have been 100% owned by Royal Dutch Shell since the middle 1980s. Before that time, we were partially owned by American investors, but mostly owned by Royal Dutch Shell.
All right. And I'm curious, this is a follow-up to that. Do you see any problem at all with what amounts to foreign control of significant portions of America's energy supply?
Well, we're in a world that trades internationally. It's a global world. I think that, we're publicly listed on the New York Stock Exchange, on the Amsterdam Exchange, on the London Stock Exchange. I think we have about 250,000 people who get their paychecks every week in the United States from Shell or subsidiaries of Shell or our wholesale network or Jiffy Lube stores. By all practical purposes, we're an American company. It's no different than GE doing business in Europe, for example, where they're an American company doing business in Europe, but their employees are European. They have intellectual property that's based in Europe. And so it's that kind of global world we live in where, you know, we follow the laws of every country we operate in.
Fair enough, and more to come. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. We'll learn some more about these myths of oil exploration and production and take some more calls as well with John Hoffmeister, president of Shell Oil USA. This is the Jimbo Hannon Show on Westwood One. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show. Our guest is John Hoffmeister, president of Shell Oil USA. We'll get some more calls here. Let me hear some more of these myths about oil that you discussed on your tour across the country.
Well, we had a lot of enthusiasm almost every city we went to where the view was that alternative fuels will be the magic bullet of the future. So biofuels, the magic bullet of the future, or solar or wind. And, you know, Shell's been in the biofuels business for 30 years. We've been in the wind business for 10 years and the solar business for 10 years. And after investing, over the last, say, 5 years, $1 billion, We have yet to declare any of these businesses successful, material, profitable businesses because this is tough going. Generally, hydrocarbon energy is cheap. Coal is cheap. Oil, while it's much more expensive than it was 5 or 10 years ago, is still cheap relative to many other sources of energy. So it's going to take us, I do believe in alternative fuels, and we're working on it as hard as we can and as fast as we can, but it's not a silver bullet. It's going to take decades for alternative fuels to make a material difference in our country.
Do you think of yourself as an energy company or a petroleum company?
Well, to be blunt about it, we have to be honest and say we're primarily an oil and gas company. Mm-hmm. You know, most of our profit, most of our investment is oil and gas because the 10,000 gallons a second has to be resupplied. Every day I've got to worry about 14,000 gas Shell stations getting resupplied. So I can't go off and do something that's distracting or different. We got to get those dealers their gasoline every day, or heating oil, or aviation fuel, or whatever it is.
Or pharmaceuticals, or plastics.
The petrochemicals, absolutely.
I've always felt in a way that it's almost a waste to be burning all of this stuff when you look at all the miracles that we produce from it just in a laboratory.
Well, and so the alternatives will play a role, but over the next 20 to 30, 40 years, rather than over the next 10 or 20 years, in terms of a material business.
Okay, here's a call from Paul in Richland, Washington. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
We're well, thank you.
I wanted to commend you on actually some frank talk about nuclear power, and that's the industry I work in, and also the realization that we are going to have fossil fuels in order to supply the world energy needs. What I wanted to make a comment on is that there's a lot of hype over wind power being green energy, and the companies talking about, utilities talking about going green. And the inconvenient truth about wind power is that the actual carbon footprint associated with it doesn't make it that green, and that the amount of energy produced from a wind turbine over its lifetime compared to the amount of energy and carbon emissions put into the steel production and the transportation and erection of wind turbines does not make it that green of an alternative. So I just wanted to make that statement. When start talking about going green, there's really no completely green solution to our energy needs.
Well, perhaps not, but I mean, let's face it, that's energy that's just going to waste, and if you can tap into it, that's clearly a preferable course to follow. That it may not be a perfectly green source of energy, it doesn't alter the fact that it still ought to be pursued.
I agree wholeheartedly. I just would like to clarify the myth that wind is green because there's really no energy.
Well, that is not 100% absolutely pure Prel shampoo green. Okay, we'll go you that distance. Any comment, Mr. Hoffmeister?
No, I agree. I think it is non-CO2 producing, but obviously to set up the transmission towers, the wires, the tower itself, yeah, there is a carbon footprint there.
I mean, I must confess, I had a chance a few years ago to drive what was at the time a prototype General Motors electric car, which impressed me, by the way. It had better pickup than I expected. Some of the space inside was a little cramped, but I guess batteries will get smaller as the technology improves. But as I trickle-charged that sucker overnight, it occurred to me I really didn't know how my local power plant produces that electricity. I really don't know. I've never been by. I pay the bill on time. That's about the extent of my relationship. And so for all I know, that clean electric car was coming from someplace belching smoke. I mean, I literally didn't know, and it's something to keep in mind. More to come here. Let's go to Nick in Simpsonville, South Carolina, for John Hoffmeister.
Howdy.
Hello.
I had heard a while back a broadcast about where I think the government was going to tax the oil companies millions of dollars or fine them millions of dollars because of supposedly, you know, excess profits or whatever. Did they ever do that? And if they did, wouldn't that be about the most, you know, boneheaded thing they could do? Because all that's going to do is get passed on to us, the consumers, anyhow.
All right. Thoughts about it?
Well, we've tried excess profits tax in this country, and what it led to was more imports, because you're talking about global oil companies that can, you know, move their assets and resources around the world, and if it becomes prohibitively expensive to invest in energy development in this country because of the high taxes that are placed on the profits of the companies, then it really does it acts as a disincentive to try to invest new money. Now, Shell, in the last 6 months, here's a true story. In the last 6 months, Shell has committed $7 billion in the United States to increase energy supplies by expanding refinery, by going for new leases in the Chukchi Sea, new leases in the Gulf of Mexico, and developing just our normal capital spending plan in our business. This past week, the U.S. House of Representatives passed what in essence is, I wouldn't call it an excess profits tax, but it's a elimination of the ability to treat our depreciation allowances as a typical manufacturer, which is going to cost us billions of dollars. The estimate is around $18 billion. But here's another rub. Only five companies are going to be asked to pay that money. Five companies by name in the tax law as passed by the House are going to have to pay this $18 billion, not the whole industry, just five companies.
Why?
I don't understand the logic behind it, but the five companies are the five big ones, and we can all name them. But here is a punitive tax bill that says to me, a company that just decided to spend $7 billion in the last six months, that we're now going to tax you because you're spending all this money. Well, what do I say to shareholders? What do I say to other people when costs go up? I think that's unfair public policy.
More to come. We'll be right back here at Westwood One. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-54626. I was talking with John Hoffmeister of Shell Oil USA during the break, and he took note of one of the companies that is not on that list of big fives that will get the shaft from the federal legislators, Citgo. Why aren't they on that list?
Well, I think the Congress has identified the five big oil companies to tax specifically, and I think it's easy to do because there's only five of us to speak out against it. If all of the oil companies were included, it would be a tougher sell, I think.
Citgo's the one run by Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, for Pete's sake, our good buddy down there, a little Marxist piece of crap, and that's me speaking, not our guest.
Well, I think it's but all the independents are excluded from this language, and so it's really targeting just a few companies. And yes, we're successful, we're profitable, and I don't ever object to a government policy that says, you know, you got to do this because this is public law. So if we have to pay taxes, we'll pay taxes, but it should be a level playing field.
Yeah, I mean, equal protection under the law, it almost seems to me like there's something that is vaguely unconstitutional about that, but I could be wrong. Okay, let's take one more call from Ken in Great Falls, Montana. Good evening.
Yeah, I wanted to discuss the issue of the theory of the abiotic oil.
Very briefly, we've got less than a minute.
Yeah, there's oil that they found in Russia that's 40 to 50,000 feet deep, and in Montana here where I'm at, they went back over old oil fields and found and drilled down 2 and 3 miles and found large quantities of oil just recently. So I'm a little puzzled how that oil got down there.
Well, I have to defer to our guest. I have no idea.
Well, the history of the Earth is very old, and so it would have represented some kind of geological formation that is rich in carbon deposits from some millennia way, way long ago.
All right. 30 seconds to go here. If you had the ear of the president right now, President of the United States, what would you say to him? Well, we need to do this very briefly.
Well, I would say that we have to recognize that the supply side has got to deliver more oil, which means let the oil companies go explore, go drill, and produce more oil, build more refineries, and work on alternatives over the longer term as we have the technology and the capacity to do so.
Fair enough. John Hoffmeister, our guest, is the president of Shell Oil USA. And we'll continue with more on the Jimbo Hannon Show, so stay with us. We'll be back with more discussion on a variety of topics right here at Westwood One. Hi there, and good evening, and welcome to the Jimbo Hannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-50-54626, and on the web, we're at jimbotalk.net. And we'll continue what has been an energy-related discussion tonight. in the company of author Steve Alton, who has written what is called The Shell Game, published by Sweetwater Books. It is a work of fiction, but then again, maybe with some serious overtones attached to it. Good to have you with us on the program tonight.
Appreciate you having me, Jim.
And you might want to get a little closer to that. There, either move it or yourself a little bit closer there. Very good. What's the basic premise of The Shell Game?
Well, The Shell Game is about the end of oil and the next 9/11 event that's going to push us into a war in Iran.
You consider that what, an inevitability?
I consider it a false flag event that will push us into Iran, basically for energy needs for the oil, just as the last 9/11 event was used as an excuse to get us into Iraq.
Although certainly there are other factors involved, not the least of which was the fact that, in fact, Saddam Hussein did have weapons of mass destruction. He used them on his own people. There were other reasons there. And Iran, as you use in the very first part of your book here, right at the lead chapter here, you have it. Granted, it's at the fictitious period of time here, December 11th of 2011, but Iran claims capability to build a dozen nuclear missiles. Well, they've already got some pretty advanced missile technology, and certainly on what looks like our current course of action, they're going to be allowed to obtain nuclear weapons, at which time I'm sure there will be a great many people out there who will say, well, whoop, too late to do anything now. And the idea of grandfathering in that regime with those weapons just doesn't strike me as an acceptable form of policy, regardless of whether they have oil or not.
I agree with you. But the premise of the book from the very beginning is that the neoconservative faction is concerned about Iran and enriching uranium.
Mm-hmm. So am I. Isn't anybody?
As we all should be.
Yes.
Enriching uranium means you can build nuclear suitcase bombs and give them to terrorists just as easily as you can build nuclear missiles. And so the thought process is, well, how do you stop that from happening? It's too easy to smuggle in a nuclear suitcase bomb. How do you stop 20 of them going off in 20 cities concurrently? And the plot of the book is that we'll allow one to go off, which will give us the impetus to do what we have to do with Iran. And why would you let one go off? Well, for one reason, because our army is broken at the present status. We're not in a position to invade any other country. With all of our troops tied up in Iraq, we have guys who are on the third, fourth, fifth tours of duty. So what it would take to take down Iran and knock out their military installations and their nuclear installations is some type of bombing with weapons of mass destruction, probably not nuclear because we want the oil fields, probably a chemical weapons. But the world's not going to allow us to justify that attack unless there's another Pearl Harbor event, and that is the gist of the book.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk a little bit about that and the thought process that would go into to allowing such a thing to happen. Just as an aside regarding our military, it has been eroded. Of course, that's been our own national choice because we are unwilling to prioritize and recognize that we have to have a military large enough to do what is necessary to protect the country, that we're unwilling to share the burden, which is, of course, fairly to do so through a draft. But, of course, we'll never do that because we're far too self-absorbed to ever do anything more than treat our military as mercenaries, pets, because we, of course, are far, far too good to ever get down and do anything as grubby as doing what they do. We have a very we-they attitude about these people. But if we are unwilling to do that, then at the very least, we ought to be willing to pay enough to get a military large enough. But the idea that we can't get a larger military... We're not under any kind of serious pressures right now. We're not under any kind of any serious deprivation. I don't see any gasoline rationing or sugar rationing or anything of that nature. I mean, the rest of us are going along business as usual while we erode this military. So while you're quite correct that we are eroding it, the reason we're doing so is because we're stupid and self-centered.
Well, I won't argue with the stupid and self-centered, but I will take a point with some of the other things you said. The purpose of being in Iraq, you mentioned, is weapons of mass destruction, and yet any weapons of mass destruction that were there, we put there. Back in the 80s when we were fueling the war between Iran and Iraq.
We gave them satellite photos. What At what time did we give them chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons? Those are the weapons of mass destruction.
Well, during the Reagan-Bush years, we gave them chemical weapons. We gave them chemical suits. We gave them a host of military weapons, assault weapons, helicopters.
Well, now, assault weapons and helicopters are not under the category, of course, of weapons of mass destruction, and I would really like to see the citations on those chemical weapons. I'm not aware that this country has ever sold chemical weapons to anybody.
We did provide them. The chemical weapons that were used to on the Kurds were provided by us.
Well, I'd love to see the citation on that.
I actually have a reference in my book for that.
All right. Well, what is it?
Try to dig it up at the commercial.
Okay. Very good. In any event, as a work of fiction, what is the central premise here is that that the President of the United States is what, aware of the fact that the Iranians have nukes? I mean, we can't very well engineer the explosion of one, but only one suitcase bomb so that we would have just enough of a Pearl Harbor event to justify such an action. I guess I'm trying to understand, I suppose, the development of the plot line here. How much do you have in your novel of the President of the United States knowing about what the Iranians have or are willing to do?
Well, let's back up for a second. The premise of the novel, first of all, is that first and foremost, we are running out of oil. And following your last guest, who insisted that there's 3 trillion barrels of oil still available, a lot of petroleum experts would disagree with those figures. For instance, he mentioned the tar sands in Canada. Mm-hmm. Well, it takes an awful lot of energy to get those tar sands out, including natural gas, which the Canadians aren't necessarily willing to part with. It takes energy to get energy. And according to M. Hubbard King, who was sort of the godfather of petroleum analysts, he predicted that world oil would peak somewhere around the 2003-2007 area. And we know that it probably peaked in 2005. Meaning
what,
that
world by world oil, you don't mean world oil demand, obviously. You're saying
not
what, world oil production?
World oil supplies. What's available that can be taken out of the ground? Because what I've learned and what most people don't understand is that you can't draw every single drop of oil out of the ground. It takes oil to get oil. For instance, if it takes Shell oil, 3 barrels of oil to draw out 10 barrels of oil, then you've got a surplus and you drill. But if it takes 3 barrels of oil to take out 3 barrels, it's no longer economically feasible to take it out. It's not worth it, so you can't draw it all out.
Are you saying what, for example, the shale oil reserves in the western United States are not now nor will ever be feasible to tap into?
I'm not necessarily saying that, but it takes an awful lot of expense of energy to get to those shale oil reserves.
Yeah.
And we would have already been doing it if it was economically profitable.
Well, if not at 350 a gallon, then maybe at 450 a gallon or wherever. I mean, if not at $104.52 a barrel, then maybe at 130. I don't know what the point is, but my guess would be that as prices go up, that we will reach the point where it probably is economically feasible, right?
And well, the question is that really where we want the future of the country to go? For instance, we're relying on 2 sources to determine our energy production for the next decade, 2 decades, 5 decades down the line. And that is oil companies, which are making record profits and don't want to part with those record profits, and third world countries who most of them don't necessarily like us. And so we're relying on that faith that Saudi Arabia, who's supposedly our friends, has enough surplus oil that they're going to be able to take care of us for the next 2, 3, 4 decades. And yet President Bush recently came back from Saudi Arabia looking to increase the amount of oil that was pumping out of the ground and came back with nothing. And he had a very interesting telltale statement. He said, well, I guess you can't do what you can't do.
I would agree that we certainly need to be independent of external sources of energy to the extent possible, and we haven't even remotely approached that. And obviously there are 2 ways that you can further energy independence. Well, eliminating conservation, which is one way you can certainly help, but obviously there are more of us and more energy-requiring technology in our midst, so conservation is at the best going to slow down our rate of consumption, not cut it back. You can either develop our own traditional, i.e. fossil fuel sources, or you can develop alternative sources, and I would imagine the answer probably will have to lie within both, because our energy needs are so high. It strikes me as difficult to imagine that we're not going to have to pursue the alternatives as well as our own sources of petroleum and other fossil fuels.
Agreed. And the thing that you have to realize is it takes at least 10 years to change an entire infrastructure of a country for a new energy source that's going to replace oil. What got me into writing this book was looking into peak oil and realizing that that without oil, we couldn't grow enough food to feed our country. In fact, only 2% of Americans are farmers, and yet that 2% feeds 350 million people because of oil. Well,
300 million. There.
300 million, okay. I'm sorry.
All right.
Give or take 50.
Okay.
The oil is necessary to run machinery, to get product to market, it mobilizes our economy. Mm-hmm. And when the oil tankers start slowing down, the power is going to start going out. And what the first thing that's going to be affected is the food supply.
Although, obviously, there's no reason why tractors and combines couldn't run on hydrogen fuel cells as well as automobiles, right?
Well, hydrogen fuel cells is sort of like a panacea or a solution to oil that on paper. But the reality is very explosive. It's very difficult to maintain. They haven't done it yet, and it still takes oil to build those hydrogen fuel cells.
Mm-hmm.
Listening to your guests in the green room, this is not an economic. You could call this an economic question, or you can call it a survival question. I prefer to look at it as a question of survival, because it's not about how much profit can we make, how much can we divest into drilling offshore, and all the major oil supplies have been found already. They haven't found one new oil supply over 500 million barrels for a decade.
That assumes, of course, that we'll never be able to find anything else. I mean, I personally don't know what the technology of a half a century from now may find beneath thousands and thousands of feet of ocean. But if our previous guest was correct that we're not even drilling into more than 15% of the area available off our coasts, that strikes me as very short-sighted policy. And I'm more than happy to frolic in the beach and look at oil derricks all day long.
Well, I have no problem with looking at an oil derrick on the beach, provided it's not leaking oil all
exactly.
over the sand.
Sure.
But that's not the question. The question is who's to be believed? I think Americans have lost a lot of faith in our government and a lot of faith in the oil companies, because it's hard to get straight answers from companies that are making such huge profits and using those profits to influence elections. And that's where the name for the book, The Shell Game, comes in, because these things go on and on, where when you have major industries like oil industries and pharmaceutical industries and weapons industries in feeding off the same trail as our politicians do, then who do we trust? How do we know how much oil is really left? How do we know there are really weapons of mass destruction out there?
Well, we know that, of course, because some were found and some were used. But in terms of the oil, I'd be happy to call their bluff if, in fact, they say there's energy out there along our coasts and they're lying. I'd be happy to say, okay, go explore. And then if they don't find anything, I would say, well, I guess we know who was lying. If, on the other hand, they go out and find that oil, then I guess we also know who was lying. I'd be happy to call their bluff. Let them go out and drill.
Well, there's and for the politicians who are receiving tremendous donations for their reelection policy programs, it's a little bit difficult to make that decision as well.
Well, it is that, and I'll grant you that money has had a distorting influence on our political system. There's no doubt about that. We'll come back. We'll talk some more about the novel, The Shell Game. Steve Alton is our guest, and we'll be back at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, and look at an amazing tale of, duplicity and I guess a president could do this, but we'll talk about that when we come back. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Our guest is Steve Alton, and the book is called The Shell Game. It is a novel published by Sweetwater Books. And let's take a call from Sean, who is in Lynchburg, Virginia. Sean, good evening.
Hi, Jim. How you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Hi, Steve. This is Sean. If you may recall that we met Saturday in Winchester at the book signing. I just wanted to expand maybe a little bit on what we talked about then, and maybe you could tell us a little more about some of the events of the book and whether or not you think that they could occur before this upcoming election, and to what extent, if any, the Democrats could have in all this as well.
Sean, what specifically were you referring to?
Well,
he probably signed a lot of books. My guess is he doesn't remember precisely what you talked about, Sean, so maybe you could let the rest of us in on it as well.
Well, sure. We were talking about the shell game, and, you know, we had talked about the possibility of the second 9-1-1 type of event occurring before the upcoming elections.
Okay. That is to say in real life, not just in the fictitious work here. Okay.
Yes, sir.
And so what your question was?
Well, I just wondered how likely does he really think that this could happen before the election? And
all right, very good. How likely do you consider the events in the shell game, either in the next 9 or 8 months now, or ultimately, of course, in the book, the events take place over a period of the next few years? What would you judge to be the level of likelihood of your work of fiction?
Well, in the shell game, the next 9/11 event deals with a false flag attack, a false flag meaning that the government is behind the attack, made to look like it's a terrorist attack, and yet it's allowed to succeed. It's enabled by the government itself.
Enabled by or caused by it? I mean, did the government look the other way or actually set the device?
In an effect, both. They wouldn't set the device. They'd use Iranians as patsies to do it, create a trail that led back, a trail of clues that led back to the Iranians. But in effect, it was put into place by the puppet masters. And a lot of this information was extracted by investigations that happened after September 11th attacks that had never been made public in the major media. That have never been involved in the 9/11 investigations.
We're pretty major media. Go ahead and make it public. And now we're leaving the realm of the work of fiction here and then referring to an actual event. Why? Is there something about 9/11 that you know that the rest of us don't?
It's well, I'm just the messenger. There have been several investigations that have shown that when you deal with false flag, what makes a false flag event successful is that there are war games that mimic the attacks that you're actually creating. The reality is, and which was shocking to me when I was doing the research, is that on 9/11 there were 5 separate war games that were being conducted in the northeastern quadrant of our country with NORAD, which sent our jet fighters over parts of Alaska and Iceland and over Canada, which pulled them out of the northeastern section of the quadrant.
Are you suggesting United States government complicity in the attacks of 9/11?
I'm just stating what happened. It's you can draw your own conclusions from it.
Well, I'd have to draw something a lot more serious than that. I mean, it would have to show a series of connections, including, of course, knowing that the attack was about to occur. Then you would be getting into not only the spirit of the book, the shell game, but the serious implications. We'll be back with more. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Steve Alton is our guest, and he is the author of The Shell Game. The previous caller brought up something interesting, which led to a discussion that was interrupted by the hard break on the half hour. We weren't able to finish that up, but so it was not, I guess, directly related to the story, but it's certainly interesting. You were saying, Steve, as the break intervened, that there were war games that were underway at the time of 9/11 under questionable timing. And here you'll have to go into some of the things you were telling me during the break because the audience didn't get to hear those. But just tell me what it is that you say you've unearthed here.
Well, if I can read a quick paragraph from the book,
sure,
which will explain it. Did the U.S. intelligence community know al-Qaeda's attack was coming? Yes, in fact. There were at least 5 intelligence services across the country that warned us. Did they try to stop them? Yes, but they were prevented from doing so.
On that particular date that we knew there was an attack coming?
Yes.
Who?
Well, FBI field agents in both Minneapolis and Phoenix who were close to exposing the plot were repeatedly and purposefully bottlenecked from taking action by a single supervisor, Dave Frasca. who would later receive a promotion for his actions. On the day of the attacks, the Joint Chiefs, under Vice President Dick Cheney's personal direction, scheduled and conducted 5 separate war game drills that purposely pulled interceptor jets away from the northeastern airspace corridor while deliberately inserting false blips on air traffic screens to simulate, of all things, hijacked airliners. Military jets that routinely intercept aircraft within minutes were delayed an unfathomable 80 minutes. Most never even entered the fray. While dedicated pilots and air traffic controllers desperately tried to determine what was real from what was staged, an FAA administrator, quote-unquote, accidentally destroyed the recordings of the day's tragic events, and he, too, was later promoted. Now, those are the facts.
Now, again, we're speaking from your work of fiction, but you say that in this particular case you are using factual material?
The shell game is filled with factual material.
And this is some of that factual material.
This is some of the factual
material. Now, how come we have not had hearings on this, and this has been blown wide open, and impeachment proceedings against the vice president, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, how come you're the only person who's found this, and no one else has seen fit to pursue this?
Well, actually, there are tens of thousands of people that have found it and that make up part of the 9/11 truth movement. I'm not saying that I'm part of that movement.
Well,
but
I'm,
there are architects and engineers, analysts, physicists, investigators, private investigators, police investigators.
But the government's not interested in pursuing this because we wished what, to cover up this? Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, exactly.
And not one person involved in this is patriotic enough to expose this. There is a vast conspiracy that was behind the purposeful destruction of I guess Donald Rumsfeld wasn't behind it, since he almost got killed at the Pentagon. But
Rumsfeld wasn't anywhere near the Pentagon. When
Rumsfeld was in the Pentagon. What are you talking about? He was in the building. He helped rescue people.
Well, let me just point out a couple other things, and you can come to your own conclusions. Intelligence agencies around the world knew how and when the attacks would occur, but their warnings were ignored. Wall Street investors certainly knew. A day before the attacks, domestic and foreign investors placed an unprecedented number of put orders, a put order being a leveraged bet that a stock would drop on the airlines and companies that would suffer devastating losses. I can go on and on about these convenient coincidences. I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
Of course you are. I mean,
you put this stuff forward here and say,
well, you know, draw your own conclusions. Then why have you not reported this to the appropriate congressional oversight, or are they part of the cover-up also?
I'm just an author of fiction. Yeah. There are thousands of people out there who have attempted to do these things. You have to realize that let me ask you a question. When we were investigating Monica Lewinsky's stained dress, we invested $80 million of taxpayer money to investigate that stained dress. Do you know how much the 9/11 investigations were budgeted?
No, I couldn't cite a figure.
$13 million. Did you know that
may be a misallocation of resources, but it doesn't mean that they were incorrect
or underfunded
necessarily.
The World Trade Center represented a crime scene, a federal crime scene. All of the evidence from that federal crime scene was kept from FEMA, kept from police, kept from the FBI. Homeland Security came in, took it, and shipped it to China and buried it.
Shipped what to China?
All the debris from the World Trade Center.
Was not shipped to China. It was...
Check your facts.
I certainly will. I will absolutely check that. I will certainly check that. Well, I guess we could stay with that all day, but as you say, draw your own conclusions. All right. Let's get back to the central thesis of your book. Regarding those weapons of mass destruction here, you pushed me toward page 186 of your book by, and I'll just quote here from the section to which I believe you were referring here, to maintain balance and prolong the war, this being the Iran-Iraq war, the Reagan administration secretly began supplying Saddam's regime with helicopters, bombs, and howitzers, all not weapons of mass destruction. All in direct violation of the Arms Export Control Act. It may have been, but we're talking about weapons of mass destruction here. They also, you say, gave Saddam nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare suits, sophisticated guidance systems, and components for their chemical plants, none of which are weapons of mass destruction. Was there a part here about us selling them chemical weapons? Because that isn't the part.
I'll have to hunt it down. There was also... they sold Saddam British fighter planes along with 1,500 MK-84 bombs, containing 2,000 pound payloads.
Again, not weapons of mass destruction, which was the specific point we were talking about. Was Chemical, biological, or nuclear. Those are weapons of mass destruction.
We did sell them the ingredients for biological and chemical weapons. We didn't sell them any nuclear weapons. And in fact,
were these
the
ingredients
weapons,
that could be used for anything else? I mean, again,
weapons that were used on the Kurds, we sold them
as weapons. As you say, they were already packaged as weapons.
Well, I'm not sure they would have made good pharmaceuticals, but they were used for chemicals.
I could sell the appropriate graduate level student probably any number of chemicals off of the shelves of a supermarket, and they could probably make something like this.
The problem here, Jim, is that the foreign policy that states the enemy of my enemy is my friend has had so much blowback through our country's recent history that, I mean, there are pictures of Donald Rumsfeld shaking Saddam's hand that were taken not too long ago when he was our ally.
Well, he was our ally in the sense that it was very useful to have those two malignant regimes wasting each other, and I firmly support the whole idea. Henry Kissinger said it all. What a shame they can't both lose. But certainly the Iraqis were about to lose, and providing them with help in general was a good idea. If we provided them with nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons, that was a terrible idea. Shaking his hand, I mean, it's a nasty world out there. Well, that's simply recognition of the fact that sometimes you have to deal with SOBs.
Listen, I'm not a pacifist, and I'm not a liberal. I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying. However, there is blowback to all those things. For instance, when we supplied the Mujahideen with weapons to fight the Soviets, well, we, in a sense, indirectly gave birth to al-Qaeda because it was bin Laden who was one of the leaders of the Mujahideen.
That's true. That's absolutely true. And again, with 2020 hindsight, the point is very well taken. At the time, it still struck me as a pretty good policy. If, in fact, we could have foreseen the events to come, then I'd have to agree with you. Do you think we could have, really? I mean, I don't know how we could have. I think it's unfortunate the way things turned out. I agree. And if we'd had a crystal ball, it would have been a terrible policy. But at the time, knowing what we knew, wasn't that a good idea to help the Mujahideen?
It was probably a good idea. However, you're dealing with people that you can't trust. You're dealing with third world people that have their own way of doing business. And when you get into those waters, you know, you're going to get burned. And we've been consistently burned over the years with these type of policies. This whole quote-unquote war against terror, we fueled it. Why are we in Iraq? You say it's weapons of mass destruction. But if the reason for us being in Iraq was the events of 9/11, then it doesn't make any sense.
Well, I've never suggested that the events of 9/11 were the reason to go into Iraq. And for that matter, that has not been used as a rationale by the administration either, although it makes a very convenient straw man for people who wish to set it up as such. But that is not...
Are you kidding? The Bush administration didn't use that as a rationale to go into Iraq?
No. There was never any... Well, it is a part of an axis of evil, but it was never any suggestion, any more than there was a suggestion that North Korea was behind the attacks of 9/11. There was never any evidence to indicate that there was any connection between the regime in Baghdad and the events of 9/11, although there were documented instances of some contacts, minor league, between some of the terrorists and representatives of the Saddam Hussein regime, but those were never carried to the extent of any reasonable suggestion that the Iraqis had anything to do with 9/11.
And yet, there we are in Iraq.
Not because of that.
Do you know that? I take it you're familiar or somewhat familiar with the Project for a New American Century.
I've heard the term. I don't really know much about who they are.
The Project for a New American Century is a neoconservative doctrine that basically states that the United States should maintain its world dominance through military use, and that in order to rewrite the map of the Middle East. It was necessary, and this is a document that was signed by Rumsfeld, Cheney, Jeb Bush, Paul Wolfowitz, and Scooter Libby, and a number of other people who would years later end up in the Bush administration. And this doctrine basically stated that in order to pull off this plan, they needed a new Pearl Harbor. Several years later, they got it. And they made sure that
And they actively suggested that it would be a good idea to bring one about, which is the premise of your book.
It fell into their laps, and they made sure that it was successful. I mean, 9/11, the FBI in Phoenix and the FBI in Minneapolis could have shut it down, except Dave Frasca, who was in charge of the fundamentalists.
Why haven't these people been arrested? Why hasn't this
all come out? They were
promoted. But why haven't they been arrested was my question. If, in fact, the evidence is so overwhelming, are you kidding me? The cry to get rid of these people would have been overwhelming. I mean, it's just interesting that you alone seem to know about this.
Well, I assure you that I'm not alone.
Well, then why haven't any members of Congress known about it? I mean, how far does the conspiracy go?
Because the fox is guarding the hen house, and you're asking the fox to prosecute itself.
Well,
it's not going to happen.
Which is the fox here? I mean, Homeland Security. Security, the FBI, the CIA, 535 members of Congress, are they all part of this conspiracy?
No, just a handful of people who are in key places.
Oh, well, then there is a conspiracy, you're saying. All right, more to come. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. Our guest is Steve Alton, the author of The Shell Game, a novel. And this is Jack in Dufuniak Springs, Florida. Good evening, Jack.
Hey, how you doing, Jim?
We're fine.
I was laying there listening to your show like I normally do, and this guy just, I don't know, the way he said this about bearing all this material over in China from the World Trade Center.
Yes.
It just kind of got my panties in a wad here. How do you explain this, you know, this new ship they just built?
Ship that used the metal from the wreckage of the Trade Center. I guess we must have purchased it from China, Jack.
I was thinking. Maybe they made a deal with China.
Yeah, must have been how it happened. It must have been sent over there and brought all the way back to build that ship. That's right.
Yeah. Who co-authored this book with him? Rosie O'Donnell?
No. He wrote it by himself. But
okay.
I'm sure I guess would love to respond to whatever you said there. So. Mr. Alton?
If you Google the facts about what happened to the debris from the World Trade Center, you'll find that it was sent to China. It was a federal crime area, and to touch debris from a federal crime scene is a federal crime. And yet none of it was ever – no one was allowed to investigate it. No one was allowed to check it for chemical traces or other things that would have led to different types of conclusions about
that
how
material was strenuously gone through, virtually sifted piece by piece. That's how they found so much evidence in terms of human remains. That was a project that went underway for months and months thereafter, and they were finding, you know, individual bones.
The security on that imprint was nobody could come in or out, take anything out of that. Homeland Security actually fired one of their workers who took a long lunch break. They had such security on the facility, and everything, again, was shipped to China. There are so many unanswered questions about 9/11, and there are a lot of people asking the questions. Unfortunately, none of them in the right places.
Well, get them up on Capitol Hill. Get them up on Capitol Hill. Let them testify under oath.
There was one thing, Jim, you and I were talking about at the break, and that is there were three buildings that fell on 9/11. There are two World Trade Center towers and World Trade Center number 7. World Trade Center number 7 was a 47-story building that wasn't hit by anything, and it fell at free fall speed in a matter of seconds. You know, there are a lot of people who want to know, why was that building imploded?
By whom? Presumably, the CIA? I mean...
I'm asking the questions. Nobody wants to, you know, it's not just me asking the questions, but how do you lose a 47-story building with no explanation as why it collapsed?
I wouldn't know. I'd have
to dig in. But we accept it. We accept it as a fact that, well, it just collapsed. A 47-story building just collapsed.
Well, I wouldn't know. I mean, debris hit it. I wouldn't know.
The 23rd floor of that building was where the intelligence services had their installations, and they were running in and out of there the entire day. 5 hours after the World Trade Center's collapsed, that building mysteriously collapsed.
Well, I guess it just you'd have to put it up there
it's just a conspiracy theory.
Well,
right?
it certainly would seem so at this juncture. Yeah. What was the name of that building, by the way?
World Trade Center 7.
World Trade Center 7. Okay, Dave in Rochester, Minnesota. Good evening.
Good evening, Jim. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was... I wonder how many thousand people would have to be in on this conspiracy. I think it would just boggle the mind. But I think, was it the Ronald Reagan that was built out of the remnants of the World Trade Centers?
I forget. I don't know.
No, the Ronald Reagan was around long before.
The USS New York. It's a cruiser.
Oh, okay. Very good. All right. All right. I stand corrected.
I've spoken to investigators, and I posed the same question as you have, because, you know, I didn't come at this as an activist. I came at this as a teller of fiction who was looking to tell a great story. And I was told by a private investigator that we're led to believe that it would take thousands of people to do this. In fact, it only takes a handful of people in order to put certain things into place. It only takes one person to order war games that will pull jet fighters off to prevent hijacked planes from being brought down. But you have to realize that our Air Force is pretty good at what they do, that over 60 times the previous year, any airplane whose transponder went off was intercepted within 10 minutes anywhere across the country.
We weren't into the process of intercepting civilian flights until after 9/11, unless they flew over ultra-sensitive areas.
That's simply not true. Any commercial flight, any commercial or private plane that whose transponder went off or went off course for any reason, jet fighters, for instance, Payne Stewart's plane, private plane, went off course, couldn't get any response
back. But that went way the hell off course.
And within 10 minutes, there were jet fighters escorting that plane. The most
because it was a serious question of it crashing somewhere.
The most guarded airspace in the world above the Pentagon. A plane was allowed to circle there.
Planes fly by the Pentagon every day. It's right next to the Potomac River, which is one of the busiest air corridors in the world.
That's restricted airspace over the Pentagon.
The Pentagon, maybe, but within 100 yards of the Pentagon is not. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show with Steve Alton, the author of The Shell Game. What can we do to try and influence events here? If, in fact, this is a cautionary tale, what should candidates or voters do?
Well, the purpose of writing the book was, first and foremost, to tell an entertaining story and extrapolate facts from other events that have happened to show that we are heading down a path, that the world is running out of oil, and whether that happens in 5 years or 20 years, the fact is that energy, specifically fossil fuels, are dictating our economic and foreign policy. By the time the war in Iraq is over, if it's ever over, according to John McCain, we'll have spent trillions of dollars. That money could be better spent in seeding new green technologies, using conservation. There is no replacement for oil. However, we can make what oil supplies we have last. I mean, the big thing, and your other guests started talking about it a little bit, the China, India, whose populations far exceed ours, are becoming more modernized every day and using more and more oil. Right,
one-third of the population of the Earth, and they're vastly increasing their use.
And it's a danger that we can't wait till the lights start going out on your computer before we get concerned about it. You have to do something now. You have to plan ahead. What's disconcerting to me is that none of the politicians who are running for president are even talking about energy, and that should be the number one subject because it's affecting the war, it's affecting our economy, it's affecting everything.
Steve Alton, our guest, and the book is called The Shell Game. It is published by Sweetwater Books, and this is Westwood One. Hello there. Good evening. Welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. Thank you for being with us on the program tonight. Got some good shows coming up for your perusal, and we hope that your perusal is in good shape, by the way, and be sure never to, of course, expose it during the vernal equinox. On the coming evening's program on the Jim Bohannon Show, we'll be talking to the Vice President's wife, Lynn Cheney, about her book, Blue Skies, No Fences, a memoir of childhood, and family. Also, Michael Ledeen joins us with a look at just where Iran may be going with that nuclear technology. And Jim Caviezel, the actor, best known for the film The Passion of the Christ, has a lead role in the Word of Promise audio Bible, a fresh audio dramatization of the New Testament, all on the forthcoming Jim Bohannon Show on Thursday evening. On Friday, we'll be broadcasting from the studios of WLS Radio in Chicago. And among my special guests that night will be documentary producer and former CBS Morning News host Bill Curtis, whose latest book is something quite different from him, the Prairie Table Cookbook. But we'll talk about all of the various assignments he's had over the years in the world of journalism. And we'll chat with author and journalist Bob Green, who's been out traveling the campaign trail, not to report on the candidates and the numbers and all of that, but to find out what we voters really are thinking about. Grass-fed beef and democracy at the grassroots, all on the next Jim Bohannon Show Friday night. We'll look forward to having you tune in for that. Coming up on Monday evening, we'll talk to the FBI's Randy Wolverton, a supervisory special agent from their Criminal Investigations Division, as we look at some of the worst predators in our society, those who prey on our elderly parents and grandparents. Often they are taken for a financial ride by scammers. Mass marketing fraud will be the subject Monday evening on the Jim Bohannon Show. Plus, can taking regular vacations help save your life? No, seriously. We'll discuss that with Marianne McGinnis, an editor at Prevention Magazine. That I have to hear about. We'll see whether or not vacations. In fact, at that, I suppose, if that's true, we could put down our vacation expenses as a medical deduction on our income tax. Only kidding. If somebody does that, don't tell the IRS that I said for you to do that. But anyway, it should be a fun discussion. All righty, what else we got coming up here? Well, we'll be taking a look at some of the problems in our own neighborhood with Colombia and Venezuela talking about going to war. We too often ignore our own backyard, and Barry Featherman will be with us as president and CEO of Inter-American Economic Council to talk about U.S. Latin American relations, which are often, I think, relegated to the back burner. The White House Deputy Drug Czar, Dr. Bertha Madras, will be with us on Wednesday, March the 12th, to talk about the war on drugs and about school instituting programs of random drug testing, whether or not we think that is an appropriate idea. We'll get your thoughts about that at that time, as we're always inclined to do. We'll talk about climate change with Dean Scott, the senior reporter for Climate Change and BNA Daily's Environmental Report and the International Environmental Reporter. Dean Scott on Monday night, March the 17th, St. Patty's Day evening, as it turns out. Tuesday, March the 18th, talk show host Roger Hedgecock will join us, who has written a guidebook for conservatives as the elections swing into being. And it'll be fun to see Roger again. He was part of the gathering we had in Portland, Oregon, sometime back on the 15th of February, the KXL Radio TalkFest 2008 election gathering that was a lot of fun. We had a chance to meet a lot of people and talk to Westwood One's own Lars Larson and Bill O'Reilly that evening as well. And speaking of scams, which we're going to be doing, of course, as we noted on Monday, March the 10th with Randy Wolverton of the FBI, we're going to also talk about them on Friday, March the 21st with Steve Weissman, an attorney and the author of The Truth About Avoiding Scams. There are so many people out there who wish to, frankly, just take people for a ride. I'm not sure what morality we're talking about here. These people are just amoral or what? They are certainly unworthy of being treated like fellow human beings. They're parasites and should be treated accordingly, but we'll just talk about how we defend ourselves against them because, of course, they only succeed to the extent that they're plausible. So we've got to have our plausometer, I guess, ratcheted up a couple of notches, be less gullible, a little more in the way of critical thinking would be helpful. On Friday, March the 28th, we will have Geraldo Rivera, the author of His Panic, Why Americans Fear Hispanics in the U.S. That will be a program of some differences. Geraldo is, and I don't want to overstate the case, but generally, if you are opposed to illegal immigration, you're a racist. And we'll let Geraldo set that straight. I'm sure he will disagree with that conclusion, but that's mine at the moment, and we'll see what the discussion does in terms of where that takes us. Anyway, 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, 1-866-505-4626 on the Jimbo Hannon Show. Akron, Ohio police charged Michael Kaminsky with aggravated robbery and carrying a concealed weapon. The latter referred to the knife that they found on him, not the weapon that he used to stick folks up. Actually, the stick-up weapon was a bottle of cologne colored black with a marker to look like a gun. Chanel number 357, I guess. Talk about gullible people. Not quite sure just exactly how you get gullible enough. Careful, he's got a bottle of cologne. I don't know. Anyway, it's an unusual pitch to say the least, saying that consumption of beef, pork, and chicken represent far more in greenhouse gas emissions. A Norwegian lobbying group is urging everyone to save the environment by eating whale meat. I would not kid you on that. And if you want to win a Powerball jackpot, buy your tickets in Indiana, which has sold 32 winners in Powerball's 16-year history. West Virginia, by contrast, has sold only 6. More to come on the Bohannon Show. When we come back, we'll take a call first, but when we come back, we're going to ask you a little guessing game. We're going to play some music for you. We don't have any prizes for this. It's just a case of who can identify the artist, because I hadn't heard him do some of these selections. You know who it is, but we'll see if you can identify the person. But that'll be when we come back. Right now, let's talk to Andy in Salisbury, North Carolina, on the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO. Hello, Andy.
Thanks, God. You got me before you got to the guessing game.
There you go. There you go.
I want to talk to you about the guy that you just had on, the gentleman that wrote the book.
Oh, yes, exactly.
I didn't catch his whole spiel there, but, you know, people should not be allowed to print stuff. I know we all believe in freedom of speech. But, you know, and I'll just address one thing that I heard him talk about, and that's the expediency of the jet planes that got on station.
Uh-huh.
I read a book on this whole situation, and it gives all the transmissions between planes and, you know, the whole thing. You give the actual verbiage and everything.
Oh, yeah.
You know, these guys, most of them are perfume boys. And we probably...
I'm sorry, most of them are what?
Perfume boys.
I'm not sure quite what that means.
Well, they're pure civilians. They're mama's little boys. They haven't ever wore a uniform. They have got no idea what they're talking about.
Oh, okay.
And you know, the fighters. Let's just take the fighters, and that's the only thing I'm going to address, because he was so outrageous. These guys, we got National Guard out there now taking care of business like this. That don't mean that they got a whole gaggle of pilots there at one time. They don't, you know, they have their part-time Air Force is exactly what Air National Guard is.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they get the pilots there, they got to figure what kind of load they got to load. And then they get the orders, what they got to do. And then on this particular situation, they had to go X amount of miles out in the ocean before they could turn back to go where they needed to go because of civilians complaining, them flying over, you know, civilian areas. And, you know, the whole thing. And they had no idea what the facts or the situation is. This doesn't happen in a minute and a half. Maybe if some of these little perfume boys would sign up, maybe we could use them for jet jockeys and we'd have a few more out there.
Or target practice.
I was trying to be nice.
Well, I don't see why. Why bother?
You be nice. Okay.
All right, Andy.
Okay,
thank
buddy.
You. Bye-bye. Thank you, sir. 1-866-50-JIMBO. We'll come back and take some more calls here. We'll also take a look at the remaining contests, which are really crucial. I mean, right now, if you're a superdelegate, I mean, you've got to figure that you're tripping over Barack Obama, who is weeding your garden while Hillary Clinton is cleaning your windows and doing your dishes. I mean, if you're a superdelegate, what a cushy job that is right now. And incidentally, if you're in Wyoming, Don't forget that you got caucuses coming up for the Democrats on Saturday. Next, Mississippi. That's on Tuesday, the 11th, primary there. And after that, there's a big gap from March 11th to April 22nd, and that's when Pennsylvania rolls into the picture. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, 1-866-50-54626. When we come back, I'm just curious if you can identify the particular music that we'll be playing. There is no prize involved here, just the pride of knowing that you were right. We'll be right back.
This magic moment, so different and so new, was like any other. Until I kissed you, and then it happened. It took me by surprise, I knew that you felt it too. By the look in your eyes, sweeter than wine, softer than the summer's night. Everything I want I have, whenever I hold you tight. This magic moment, while your lips are kissing mine, will last forever. Forever till the end of time.
I'm just curious if you knew who that was. You actually know the name, but you aren't used to probably hearing this person sing that particular way. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number if you have an idea. There is no prize whatsoever attached to this. 1-866-505-4626 on the Jimbo Hannon Show. Boy, it's getting tight for the Democrats. And I have to assume that a few talk show hosts, among them Rush Limbaugh, can legitimately claim some credit for this. 10%, according to exit polling, 10% of all those who voted in the Ohio Democratic presidential primary yesterday were, believe it or not, self-described Republicans. Now, if they followed what has been the conventional wisdom that Hillary is an easier target for John McCain, and the polls would bear that out, and that it is better to have the Democrats staying in disarray, then they crossed over and voted for Hillary. And also in Texas, you could do that as well. I'm wondering, you think that is a fair way to run our elections, that anybody who wants to can just pick up a ballot? I mean, technically speaking, primaries are a process of one party picking their nominee. And if you're not part of that particular party, then there's a real question, I think, of whether or not you should be involved or be allowed to be involved. I mean, just to make it into a game just strikes me as somewhat unfair, frankly. Granted, there are no membership rules for joining the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. But you ought to, I think, have to be registered as a Democrat or a Republican to vote in the primaries. And if you're registered as an independent, I don't think you have any business voting in primaries. I mean, if you are not a Democrat, why should you be a part of the process of picking a Democratic presidential nominee? You get your vote in November, and so on. 1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, 1-866-505-4626 on the Bohannon Show. Here's Naomi. She's in Montezuma, Georgia tonight. Good evening, Naomi.
Hey, Jimbo. Is that Joe Cocker?
No, it is not Joe Cocker, as a matter of fact, but that's a very interesting choice, and it certainly would not be something you would expect from Joe Cocker. No, it is not Joe Cocker. It is a man, I'll give you that. Either that or it could be, I suppose, could be Madonna with a very bad head cold. No, it's a man. It is a man who would be familiar to people who would be, I would guess, familiar with Joe Cocker. We're talking about someone not, say, of the generally thought of as the contemporary music scene. I will give you another little hint. We do not tend to think of this person as being a solo act.
Hmm. Cocker, the voice just hit me for some reason.
The voice, I'll tell you, once I tell you, you will say, oh, of course. You'll say, oh, of course. But it's difficult. Yeah, it really is. We'll play another selection from that dude in a second here. But no, it is not Joe Cocker.
Okay. No.
All right.
Well, that's the only thing I can come up with.
Well, that was good. I mean, as I say, you're not used to hearing him do some of these songs. I can tell you that this person has an album out now, and since we're using his music, I'll give credit where credit is due. But when the time comes, but we haven't found anybody who's identified the person yet. But you know the voice, boy.
Okay.
Let me ask you, Naomi, since you're anonymous, how old are you?
I'm 47.
47. Well, you might know this voice. You might know this voice.
It's probably a lot of older music.
It's probably more for people who are closer to, say, their 50s or say beyond. But you should be. You're certainly aware of the group if you have followed pop music at all. All right.
Okay. Can I ask you a question while I got down the
line?
Sure,
absolutely.
I think it was earlier you were talking about the oil.
Yes.
The oil thing. I heard someone say that the United States gave Russia some very rich land in Alaska. I'm not sure how many hundreds or thousands of acres or whatever.
No.
Just gave it to them. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, no, of course not. Of course we haven't given the Russians land in Alaska. No.
Because I thought, well, here we are.
We bought Alaska from Russia. We bought Alaska from Russia back in the 1860s,
mm-hmm.
at a time when it was called Seward's Folly, because Secretary of State Seward had recommended it, and of course everybody knew there was nothing up there but ice and snow. I saw the figure one time, but I forget how many minutes it takes, how many minutes of oil coursing through the pipeline to equal what we paid for Alaska. I think we paid like $7 million for the whole state of Alaska. Granted, those were 1860-something dollars, but still. And it's just like, you know, a fraction of a penny per acre or something. I mean, very, 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 very small.
Well, to my understanding, this was just in the last few years.
We certainly haven't given the Russians any piece of Alaska, and I don't imagine that we've sold them anything, any mineral rights. I mean, the short answer is no.
Okay, good, because I was thinking it sounded crazy, but they were emphatic about it, and I thought, oh, no.
Absolutely not. We certainly have not given them anything, whether there is any, and there are certainly Russian commercial ties with Alaska. I mean, when I was last up there, I bought, an insignia from a Red Army cap. You find lots of Red Army souvenirs on sale in Alaska. It's kind of ironic, given Vladimir Lenin's old dictum that when it comes time to hang the capitalists, they shall be found bidding on the rope. In point of fact, the Soviet Union wound up selling itself in souvenir chunks to the vicious capitalists. Kind of funny, in my view. We'll come back with more music here in a moment.
Forever my Forever, my darling, my love will be true. Always and forever, I'll love just you. Just promise me, darling, your love in return. Make this fire in my soul, dear, forever burn. My heart's at your command, dear, to keep love and to hold. Making you happy is my desire, dear. Keeping you is my goal.
Recognize that voice? Ah, you do. I mean, I guarantee you, you just are not familiar with two things. First, hearing the voice purely solo, and second, doing these songs. I'm just curious if you can guess who this artist is, because I found it intriguing what he's come out with. Steve in Shelby, Ohio. Hello there.
Hi, Jimbo.
Hi there.
Hey, the more I hear this guy, by the way, it's very nice, but the more wrong I think I am. Is it Art Garfunkel?
It is not Art Garfunkel, no, but that's a very good...
I know he had a new album out that was different, but there's no way he could sing that low.
No, that was the thing. But this would be Art Garfunkel with a really, really bad head cold.
Or B. Arthur, I don't know.
Yeah, or B. Arthur breathing helium. Yes, could be that. Right. Nope, not Art Garfunkel. All right, thank you for your call. 1-866-50-JIMBO. This is Belle in Brunswick, Georgia. Good evening.
Yes, I wanted to say earlier Tom Jones, but you say he does not do solos.
Well, at least I have not. He didn't become famous doing solos. He has, I think, been a solo artist for a number of years, but not as well known. Tom Jones would have been a great guess. It is not Tom Jones.
Okay, can I try another?
Yes, go ahead. We're not.
Tony Orlando?
It is not Tony Orlando. No, it is not Tony Orlando. I just found it interesting. I came across this CD. I had not been aware of his solo work, and when I started hearing some of the cuts on it, I thought, boy, you know, I don't know that I would have guessed that's who that was, so I thought I'd just play with the audience a bit. All right, we'll give it one more try at the next break, and we'll see if anybody else can figure it out, or I'll just tell you. I'll be open about it. Thanks you very much, Belle. I appreciate your call. 1-866-50-JIMBO. We go to Mirabelle in East Northport, New York. Good evening, Mirabelle.
Good evening, Jim. I don't know his name either, but he's got a beautiful voice.
Yes, he does.
Lovely. Love the song, too. I was thinking of somebody like Hawaiian, like, what's it, Don Ho, whatever, more that way, you know?
No, it's not Don Ho. No, the late Don Ho, of course, was known as for solo work. In fact, he did pass away recently. This particular gentleman is still alive.
I did read that, yeah. But anyhow, the voice that I heard tonight is very beautiful.
Yes,
but you asked before about, you know, what was going on with the primaries.
Right. Both the issue of open primaries,
yeah,
and the crossover vote. And as long as we brought the subject up, I'm willing to pursue also the issue of whether or not the folks in Florida and Michigan, the Democrats there, should get a second shot at actually voting so that it counts. But
yeah,
go ahead.
I would think so, definitely.
Think so.
But as far as the crossover, it seems to me if that's going to be allowed, and I don't know how they're going to stop that, but if that's going to be allowed, could that go on in every state then? And then it seems to me that the opposing party could really pick the nominee for the other party.
Well, they could if they don't have a race of their own. And, of course, for these last few races, that
yeah,
is the case with the Republicans.
Right.
Their nominee is picked.
Yeah.
You could. Different states have different rules.
Yeah.
Some states say that if you're going to vote in the Republican primary, you must be a registered Republican, or
yeah,
in the Democratic primary, a registered Democrat. Others are very open and let people of either party or independents vote in whichever primary they want. And if I'm not mistaken, the two big states on Tuesday,
yeah,
Texas and Ohio, both did that. It just strikes me as somewhat unfair. Now, granted, there's nothing to keep someone from changing their registration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like somebody, but you have to do that within a certain period of time before an election. But
yeah,
there would be nothing to stop, say, a Republican in Texas or Ohio from having changed their registration.
No,
so
I understand.
Yeah, but I kind of.
But I don't think it's a game, Jim, as far as wanting to keep Obama and Hillary at each other. I think it's, like you said before, the possibility of getting the weakest candidate up against Mr.
McCain. Yeah.
And I don't think that's really fair at all, because that's a rigged election as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it's not a rigged election. Since it's not illegal, I mean, what they're doing, I have no problem with it. And since I'm not predisposed towards either of these two candidates, I have no problem with the tactic since it's allowed. But in a basic arena of fairness, it just seems to me that it should not be done that way, that you ought to have to be a registered Republican to vote in the Republican primary, a registered Democrat to vote in the Democratic primary. That's my thought. Yeah. Anyway,
how about the man who's been promoting it?
Well, a number have, including Rush Limbaugh, but what about him?
Well,
he's a very famous person and very rich. That's what about him. Okay. 1-866-50-JIMBO. Let's talk to Dan in Susanville, California. Hello.
Hey, Jim. How you doing?
I'm well, thank you.
I'm kind of going to have to disagree with you on the whole primary thing. Mm-hmm. I'm an independent.
Right.
And I'm an American citizen just like you, and I think I should be able to vote for whoever I want.
Well, you can in the general election.
Right.
But a primary election is not a general election. It is, in effect, it is a closed club. It is the Democrats picking their nominee.
Right, which is wrong to me, I think.
Why should the Democrats not be allowed to pick their own nominee?
Well, no, why shouldn't I be able to vote for whoever I want?
You can in November.
Well, no, as an independent in the primary.
Because the primary is not for independents or Republicans in this case. A Democratic primary is for Democrats to pick their nominee.
So basically the independents have no voice until
no,
November.
No, well, you shouldn't have a voice until November.
Why is that?
Because you're not affiliated with a party.
Why do you
primaries are not an election per se. Primaries are a choice within a party of who they want to run in an election.
Yeah,
and if you're not a member of the club, why should you be helping to pick it?
Well, it shouldn't be a club, first of all.
Well, it is a club.
Okay.
It is the choice of a party for whom they wish to run in November. That's
okay,
what it is.
But check it out. If I see somebody in a primary who I think would be a great president for the United States as an American citizen,
there's nothing
I want
to
vote for the best person.
There's nothing to keep you from registering with that party and voting in that primary.
Yeah, but like you said, there's a certain time limit or whatever.
Well, I mean, the time limit shouldn't be unreasonable, but I mean, certainly in the case of California, you knew who the candidates were for months before it came time to actually vote in California. And if you felt so strongly about one candidate or another that you wanted to vote in the primary, you could have registered as a Democrat in California, I'm sure, easily, long before you had to meet any deadline.
I understand that, but this is what I'm saying. I don't care if I was a registered Republican or Democrat. If I see somebody I think would be better for the country, I'll vote either way. You know,
and you should
matter.
Have that right, but only in the general election.
It's okay, but I don't agree, because I think only, you know, I think it's kind of stupid that just because you're part of a party, you have to vote for some person, even though you don't like them.
No. You don't have to vote for somebody if you don't like them. You missed the point entirely. You don't have to vote for anybody, but the only people who should be voting are members of that party, okay? You have no reason to be voting until November if you're an independent. If you don't have a party to vote for, why do you want to interfere in their choice of a nominee?
You're an American citizen.
Yes, but an American citizen does not grant you the right automatically to vote in a primary, and I don't think it should. None of your rights are being abrogated. You have every right to vote in the general election.
Right, but if you wanted to vote for somebody you thought was better,
then you can register in the primary as that party.
Well, all right. I'm just going to have to disagree with you on that.
Well, I guess. I understand that you do. I haven't heard a good reason yet to think to the contrary of how I feel about it, but okay, fair enough. 1-866-50-JIMBO, and we'll come back and get you one more crack at that song right after these messages.
I'm going up, I'm going down, I'm going up, down, down, up, anywhere you want me to go.
Who do you think that is?
You got me doing what you want me, baby, what you want me to do.
All right, Ruth in Charlottesville, Virginia joins us. Hello, Ruth.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Jimbo. How's it going?
It's going well.
Good. I think it's Al Hibbler.
It is not Al Hibbler, no.
Oh.
I'm sorry about that.
That's all right.
All right. Thank you for your call. You betcha. Let's try Wendy in Columbia, Missouri. Hello.
Hi. I think it's Michael, Davis from the Doobie Brothers. Michael Douglas.
It is not. No. It is not. From
it
the
is not.
No.
Okay, I was sure it was. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, let's go now to Kyle, who is in Osakis, Minnesota this evening. Good evening, Kyle.
Good evening. How are we doing?
Very well, thank you.
I believe it's one of the Everly brothers.
No.
Really?
No.
I'd have sworn that with that baritone voice, it would have been one of them.
Yeah, no, it is not.
Very well.
All right. Thank you. Let's see what John in Rome, New York has to offer for us tonight. Good evening, John.
Hi, Jim. That's Bill Medley.
Ha ha! You are correct, sir. It is from a brother, okay, although they weren't really brothers, the Righteous Brothers. That is Bill Medley. Yes, sir.
Surviving member, yeah.
And now, of course, everybody's saying, oh, of course, we have the great gross national head slap. Oh, yes, of course. No!
I knew it right from the very beginning, but I just couldn't get the line. And
yeah, it is Bill Medley.
It's being a guitar player since 1961, I kind of know
it. It's called Dedicated to the Blues. And that's his new CD, and it's really pretty neat. It got all kinds of good stuff on there. But when I heard it, I thought, A, it's good, but B, boy, it's almost like hearing, Frank Sinatra doing rap music. You know? The voice doesn't fit with that particular style.
I always wanted to get to talk to you because you mentioned that your service in Vietnam. I was stationed in Long Bend in 1967 with the 572nd Trans. We supported the 101st Airborne, 25th Division at Coochie, 1st Infantry at IK.
I was TDY'd up to the 25th at Coochie. I forget when now, but for like 2 days. They at the particular base I went to, the only hot shower I had the entire year over there. What happened was a deuce and a half truck got hit by a mortar, and it knocked out the back half of the truck, but the engine was still good. So they took the engine and hooked it up to the radiator to the shower. Now, it was the world's loudest shower, but the water was hot. It was too cool.
It's funny how, I remember telling a friend of mine, I says, what are you going to do when you get back to the world? I says, well, I'm going to try to remember how to use the handle on the toilet.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, and have to try to remember not to whiz outdoors in front of people into a tube. Well, you had to be there, folks. You had to be there.
It was great getting to talk to you, and I love the show.
I thank you very much, John, and good guess. Absolutely. Yes, that is Bill Medley, formerly of the Righteous Brothers, and it's a CD called Dedicated to the Blues. It's got some good stuff on there. I enjoy listening to that. I'm looking here over the list, and it's all blues stuff. There's not a single Righteous Brothers song on there. All righty, let's talk to Billy in Dothan, Alabama. Hello, Billy.
This is Joey in Dothan.
Joey in Dothan. Well, very good Joey in Dothan it is.
The independent voter who was saying they should cross over.
Yeah.
Well, as long as the taxpayers are funding the election, sure. But if the Democrats and the different parties want to fund their own, because I don't think we as taxpayers should fund the individual parties anyhow. I mean, I just don't feel like it's fair for an independent to fund the Democratic Party or the Republican Party.
Well, you're not funding the party per se to see to it that, in fact, a primary election is held, which is allowed by state law, and that people are at the polls
If the Democrats want to support the Democrat, they would do that financially as well. They've made it a money situation where you could have a very qualified man who's an accountant or whatever, but he can never get an office because he doesn't have the money.
Money plays an inappropriate level of influence in our elections. I wouldn't deny that, but are you suggesting that, for example, let's say an underfunded party, let's say that the Green Party or the Libertarians are having a primary, but they can't afford their prorated share of that election. They should be, what, stricken from the ballot and not allowed to have a primary election?
However the parties want to elect their candidate, they elect them. You know, if they want to elect them from three states...
Well, I disagree. I think that every state there should be primary elections. They've proven to be a very effective means of gaining public participation in the process, and I have no problem with the state paying for the primary elections. That's not certainly funding for the candidates or anything like that. It just strikes me as a very doable thing, but at the same time, I don't see why others should be involved in just choosing to play games here. If you're a registered Republican or Democrat, then take part in your primary, but you don't have a right to vote in any time other, as far as I'm concerned, except the general election. Here is Tom in Los Gatos, California. Hello.
Hey, that was a great story, the Vietnam story with the radiator and the old wreck. Yeah, now America knows what we could do with the radiator from Rusty's car, Gordon's car from the NASCAR race last weekend. Did you see that wreck?
No, I didn't. Was there another wreck?
Yeah, Gordon had a slam in with two other guys, and his front end was smashed, and his radiator was skidding across the track. He was spewing fluid.
How they survived those crashes is beyond me.
Yeah, but you know, if it shows up on eBay, you know, they'd make a great shower, you know, NASCAR shower.
Wouldn't it? Yeah. I bet, honestly, that they're a little loud. I mean, I enjoyed the warm water after, by that time, I'd been in country about 9 months, and the cold showers had gotten a little old. But it was very loud. They didn't rescue the muffler, so it was a truck engine with a straight pipe, no muffler.
You got to go over in Silicon Valley, but I wanted to say on the elections, I think it'd be interesting if Hillary pulls out, not because she's bad or anything, but she puts in her husband as the vice presidential candidate with Obama.
But unfortunately, he cannot, because the vice presidential candidate has to be constitutionally eligible to be president. And having served two full terms in the presidency, Bill Clinton is ineligible to be president. Therefore, he is ineligible to be vice president.
Oh, in case the president dies or something in office. Yeah, that's a good point. Because, you know, Rush Limbaugh has been telling his people to vote for Hillary, you know, the conservative Democrats,
sure,
to keep the fight going between Barack and, you know, Hillary as long as possible.
Right.
So I think that would solve that problem. But also on the other problem, the prince coming out of Afghanistan,
right.
I think that was the greatest thing that ever happened. It just reminds me of what Golda Meir said, there'd be peace in the Middle East when the Arabs love their children or more than they hate the enemy. And that's what
there
the
you
British
go. Will. All right. Well, tell you what, we're flat out of time. We'll be right back.
Exciting and...
Oh, yeah, there's a search underway.
What we're trying to find is the greatest romantic.
And who better to lead the search than actor Gavin McLeod, otherwise known as Captain Meryl Stubing of The Love Boat, as the Season 1, Volume 1 Love Boat DVD is now out.
To celebrate the release of the first season DVD of The Love Boat television series, Princess Cruises, which was known as The Love Boat, is having this contest.
So if you or someone you know is greatest romantic material,
contestants will submit a video of 3 minutes or less telling us why they or someone else they know deserves this award.
You've got till March 20th to submit your video at the website greatestromantic.princesscruises.com. That's a video, 3 minutes or less, to greatestromantic.princesscruises.com. And submit it by Thursday, March 20th.
Then we'll choose 5 semifinalists. They'll be announced April 1, and then the public will then vote for the grand prize winner.
Who'll be named April 15th and have all his taxes paid. No, I made that up. Actually, it says Gavin, they get a 7-day cruise for two.
The winner is going to be awarded a fabulous cruise on one of the princess ships to the Mexican Riviera or the Caribbean, including airfare.
With another honor,
the winner will be known as the ambassador of romance for 1 year at Princess Cruises.
How cool is that? Who decides?
It would be judged by myself, Dr. Ruth Westheimer,
Trish McDermott and Lisa Light.
So, Captain Steubing, who of your shipmates, so to speak, aboard the Pacific Princess, would you consider the greatest romantic?
Marion Ross played a woman on the show the last 2 years that the captain had a relationship with, and the last Love Boat we ever filmed, they got married.
Oh, yeah. Did Richie Cunningham ever find out? Say, Gavin, what else are you up to these days?
I have a movie that's coming out in September. It's called The Secrets of Jonathan Sperry. Robert Guillaume is in it with me.
Well, I guess it beats being a writer in Lou Grant's newsroom. So there you have it. Good luck. And thanks to our producer and webmaster, Mr. Paul Hill. We're at JimboTalk.net. Our engineer is Ted Schneider. I'm Jim Bohannon on Westwood One.